Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones. And, of course, I'm your host, Aaron. And joining me today is Anthony LaDon. Say hi, Anthony.
Hi, Anthony.
The old jokes are the best jokes. We have been, for the better part of this year, co-writing a book called Gods of Thrones. And if you are hearing this podcast right now, it means you can go and order it right now on Amazon.com. There'll be a link for that in the show notes. If you're a Kickstarter patron backer, thank you very much for your support. You should already have gotten your ebook some days ago. And if you have the book in your hands, your digital copy in your digital hands, and you are moved to give us a review on Amazon, that would be awesome, because we're trying to take over Amazon, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Had a long-standing beef with Bezos, so if we can just like run his Kindle desktop publishing, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I guess we should probably make it clear that we're not looking for good reviews. Mm-hmm. We want honest reviews.
Yes, that will happen to be good because we wrote a good book.
Exactly. But in addition to the fact that they are honest reviews, they are reviews.
Yes.
And we need at least 50 reviews to really promote the book well. Uh-huh. So let's try to get that 50.
Yeah, and this is going to be a series of nakedly disguised advertisements for both Anthony and I's book, and I don't know if you've heard it, George Martin actually has a book later on in November.
He writes books?
He does. He's a little known TV script writer. It's weird. He's doing the Silmarillion before he's finished The Lord of the Rings. It's an interesting choice, but he's doing this Targaryen history, this Fire and Blood, which we're going to be doing a couple weeks here, Gods of Thrones, and when that comes out, I'm going to have Anthony joining me. We're going to have other couple podcasters joining me. Joanna from Cast of Kings is going to be coming on to talk of Fire and Blood. We're going to have Kim Renfro from The Insider. Again, Anthony will be joining me. Maybe Jim, but as you know, he's more of a TV watcher and not as much deep dive into the history of Westeros as myself. But we're going to be doing over the next 5 or 6 weeks, we're going to be talking about topics from our book, Gods of Thrones, and also kind of reviewing and doing a book club of Fire and Blood when it comes out later in November. So that is kind of like, if you weren't going along with Jim and I on our season 3 rewatch, we kind of talked about the schedule here. We're going to really blow up November and December a little bit with Game of Thrones, and it'll just be a short few months until we're in the middle of season 8. You can send feedback on this series to gameofthrones@baldmove.com like you always do, probably prioritizing kind of like book discussion over just general, what do you think is going to happen in season 8? Because also, desperately trying to avoid spoilers for season 8 for myself. So, and it's almost upon us. So I guess first things first, maybe we talk about something that kind of Jim and I do on our commission podcast, our experience with the thing we're about to talk about. What's your exposure level to Game of Thrones? What brought you into the fandom? I'm assuming that you're a fan. I mean, I've been working with you for about 10 months, so I'm pretty sure you are. But just talk about your background with the Game of Thrones universe, Anthony.
I was one of the many, many people whose first exposure to Game of Thrones was with Season 1, Episode 1. Although I'm a big fan of fantasy literature, I, like many people who are, am often disappointed with a lot of fantasy literature.
Right.
So when I saw Season 1, Episode 1, for the first time, I realized this is different. There's something else. There's something behind here that's not derivative, that's not embarrassing at times. The dialogue isn't embarrassing.
Right.
So what I did was that very week that I saw that, I ran out and bought the first book, and I just started plowing through the books, so that by the time season one ended, I was already, you know, 3 books in.
Oh, wow.
So
I was going to ask you, because there's always that like surface tension when you get to the end of the first volume. It's like, should I stay here and preserve the purity, or did I keep charging ahead? Clearly.
I kept charging ahead for sure. And I think so. I've always sort of read the thing as a sort of almost parallel narratives. and enjoyed those as such. So my history certainly isn't as long as people who were on with Game and, you know, the early 2000s.
Right, right.
But that's my basic history of it. I mean, we could talk about the background for the idea of this particular book, but I want to ask you because I've listened to a lot of Bald Move podcasts, but I've never heard you talk about how you first encountered Martin's work and how you and Jim decided to start covering this.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of that like backstory is kind of lost to internet because I used to co-host with another guy, the Night's Watch podcast, and then we stopped doing that and those podcasts kind of like fell off the internet. I was aware of Game of Thrones within a few years of it first being published because I, you know, was a big Tolkien fan when I was in high school, big fantasy sci-fi nerd. And I had also had always tried to recapture that magic, you know, and I was like trying to get into the Wheel of Time
books. As we all do.
I tried to make it through Wheel of Time 3 or 4 times, yeah. And like there's just so much derivative from Tolkien. There's so many long, aggressively apostrophized and umulet bearing names that was confounding, but several of those things. I've tried different things, and I remember when someone suggested you should really try Game of Thrones, I was like, yeah, whatever. And then HBO was going to adapt it, and I remember watching the first episode and having a hard time figuring out what the hell was going on, because it reminded me a lot of The Wire. There's just like so many characters and so many intense political situations, and like, who is this dead guy with the stones on his eyes? Who are the two blondes that are talking? Oh my God, they're brother and sister. Jesus, he just threw that person out a window. It's a kid. So I remember really liking it and kind of picking it up as I went along. And then when you got to the climax of season 1, the beheading of Ned, spoilers for season 1 of Game of Thrones, I remember thinking, wow, I've never seen anything like that. That's so ballsy to have this central character that you just realistically terminate at the end. It really grabbed my attention. So I tried, Jim and I were podcasting by then, tried to get him into it, but he's always a tough sell on fantasy. So I got a guy that I worked with and I started co-hosting with him. But I read the first book and the first two books in between season 1 and season 2.
Because
my plan was I was going to kind of be the guy that provided the background lore, but not too far ahead that I could just like start being an obnoxious dick about spoilers. But then, you know, after the second season, I was weak and I read, you know, I read the rest of them, including Feast and Dance. And then Jim, you know, like I said, when the podcaster and I stopped doing it, by that time, Jim had heard enough of our podcast and me excited enough about it. And also, crucially, I think around the same time, around season 3, I started noticing non-fantasy people picking up, like Bill Simmons, who, like, all throughout season 2, people were like, you should watch this. He's like, I don't like this, like, walking through woods genre, like, you know, and dragon genre. And then, you know, you get him hooked and they realize that that's like saying, I don't want to watch The Wire because I don't like cop procedurals.
Right.
It elevates it. So I'm a self-described lore whore. And the lore in Game of Thrones is amongst the tastiest and deep of fantasy genres. It just goes on forever and ever. There's a whole tome of Targaryen history about the hitters we're talking about. Yeah. So I was curious because, like, so we're both Game of Thrones fans, and I've been podcasting about this for going on 7 years now. I guess, what do you bring to the table above and beyond your average fan?
Right. I don't know. I mean, that's a good question if my fandom will be deemed worthy. But here's my sort of professional hazard is that I teach religion. I teach at a Christian seminary, and I've done a lot of reading and writing about ancient and modern religions. So one of the first things I noticed about Martin's world was that it sort of passes the authenticity smell test because it is rotten with religion.
Do you remember, like, when you were watching or reading when that first, oh, this guy's done his homework, or this feels real?
Yeah. So I was confused. At the very beginning, I was confused because I figured that these maesters were some sort of priestly,
like a monk set.
Yeah. Because really, in the medieval world, you didn't have maesters.
Right.
In our world.
Right.
There weren't maesters.
Right.
But the Catholic Church would employ people to be academics.
Right.
So you get that's how you get people like Galileo. So I think initially I was confused about this whole business with the maesters, and I figured they must be sort of the equivalent to the Catholic Church, and I didn't.
They're the Jesuit arm.
Something like that. And when I realized that these are actually distinct groups, the faith of the seven is distinct from the maesters, it made me, you know, it sort of piqued my curiosity. And I think that there's a moment in the first season when in the show Picel is sort of saying, Ned's head is on the chopping block, basically. And Picel is speaking to the whole group. And he says, the mother is of mercy, so you could choose mercy, Joffrey.
Right.
But of course, the father is of justice.
He's a real hard ass.
Yeah, you can choose justice. And of course, what Picel's doing is he's saying, hey, whatever you choose, Joffrey.
You got your back.
We're going to give you theological backing for whatever you say. And I realized that these were not Picel's lines in the books. Right? This is the High Septon that's talking about this in the books. So that was season one, and I was kind of new to it. And so I started wondering, like, oh, I wonder what's really going on with, and what are the differences here? And then, of course, from the beginning of season two, religion is all over the place because you've got Melisandre.
Right.
And I think at that point, I was kind of curious to see where this all was going to go.
Right.
Long story short, I tend to see the world in certain categories because of my field of study, and I realized that Martin had really done his homework when it came to sort of this sort of medieval saturation with worship and the sacred and things like that.
How it all works like culturally and politically and kind of, you know, those intersections.
That's right.
Now, I heard that you also taught Game of Thrones in the form of an ethics class.
I did.
Some point.
Oh, that was fun.
Is essentially the moral is there is no ethics?
No.
No,
I'm so glad you asked. So I did this class. I was teaching adjunct school, University of the Pacific in California. And this is it's kind of a cool idea for a class. Basically, every student that goes through their 4-year institution has to take an ethics class at the beginning and at the end of their career as a student. So, as all adjunct professors know, sometimes you get like a call 2 days before the class starts. Hey, we got someone that dropped out. Can you teach this class? I'd never taught a class on ethics before. So I thought, all right, in order to make this work, I've got to make this class my own. I need to make them choose books that I've read before.
Right.
So here are the three options that I gave them. I gave them A Year of Living Biblically by A.J. Jacobs, which is sort of like comedy journal, basically. I gave them The Autobiography of Malcolm X, which is one of my favorite books. And I gave them a Game of Thrones. And what I did with the book was they were going to chart they had to pick one character. And the example that I gave was Ned Stark. Because philosophically speaking, I think Ned Stark is a great example of deontology. He's got this idea of honor that's like this heavenly standard, and you've got to live up to it. He is not a consequentialist by nature. A consequentialist is saying, well, what decision is going to make the most people happy for the longest duration of time? So even if it may be the wrong thing, even if I have to tell this little lie, it'll save a million lives.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I was trying to teach these concepts to the students, philosophically speaking. And, you know, so I got them to think, is Ned Stark a deontologist or a consequentialist? And then, of course, at the end, Ned totally subverts this because he decides to lie because he thinks it's going to save the realm or save his children or something.
Right.
And then, of course, Martin chops his head off.
Yeah.
So I just love to bring some sort of theological or philosophical background into my reading of these texts. And I think that's a little bit of what we're doing in this book, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, it seems like from that acorn, a mighty tree has grown. Because I clearly, as you started talking about those concepts, I'm like, I know exactly in the book, Gods of Thrones, where it eventually went with this.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood and the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Before we get too much further, I feel like we need to take a step back and talk about this book, Gods of Thrones, subtitled A Pilgrim's
Guide to the Religions of Ice and Fire.
Thank you. What is this book? What are we trying to do with it? And the other thing is, like, I feel like that subtitle makes it seem very serious and intimidating, when in reality, we've enjoyed, like, super serious but tongue-in-cheek analysis of pop culture.
Did you ever read Board of the Rings by the National Lampoon's guys?
I have.
All right. So when I remember first looking at that book and opening it up, it felt sacrilegious to me because I was so in love with Middle Earth that to hear people sort of making fun of hobbits and whatnot seemed, I don't know, I wasn't ready for it.
Right.
But looking back, it's kind of brilliant. And it's one of those cases where mockery is the best form of flattery.
Right.
And I think we're doing a little bit of that in this book.
And there's like, I have a long history of this kind of stuff. Like, I really liked Larry Niven growing up, and I found in a collection of short stories that he wrote this really dry scientific examination of what Superman's sex life would be like. And it was called Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex. And he does things, calculates the ejaculate speed of Superman, and in the throes of passion, how would he control his, and if he was exposed to red Krypton, his spermatozoa might do this, and be exposed, and it's like,
turn into little ants or something.
Yeah, and it's like if a scientist had decided to get really super serious about, I always think like, serious examination of something that's kind of trivial is fun.
Right. No, I think that there's an element of this where it's, you know, some people just need to just see the world in particles.
Right.
Some people see it in sort of grand narratives.
Right.
And however you, whatever your approach is to your worldview.
Right.
You're going to have an opinion about sort of these larger cultural phenomena. And Martin's, the world that Martin has built is going to attract all kinds of different opinions,
right?
And it just so happens that you and I have opinions about religions, mm-hmm. and gods and sociology. Mm-hmm. And we also want to make a couple jokes along the way.
Yeah, like we'll be like quoting from Confucius, and then suddenly we work in a lyric from the Notorious B.I.G., or
absolutely.
We'll be talking about the possibility of Bran using his Weirwood network to transcend the boundaries of time and space, and then suddenly we talk about the Futurama episode where Fry went back and impregnates his own grandmother.
It's appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. It's not like Family Guy humor where it's just pop culture references for the sake of it. I love the way we use footnotes. If you get a footnote, it might be a reference to a material, or it might be a meta joke about something that we're making. It's that kind of book.
It's a little bit like if Christopher Guest was going to do a mockumentary on George Martin's
sure.
religious landscape.
Right.
But, you know, if you know Christopher Guest, you know that he's done a lot of research and he really sure. understands the world that he's mocking.
Which is right? why, like, that's the thing. Like, the sturdier the bones that humor has to build upon, the funnier it is, I think. So, like, the more real and studious the scholarship, the more fun you can have with the material itself.
My problem always was that for some reason, I thought the 1980s was the funniest decade, and so most of my footnotes relate to some bit of pop culture from the 1980s.
Right.
And then you were always saying, come on, we can't have another David Hasselhoff joke.
Right. Yeah. Which, the thing is, like, because I'm in that old Gen X category where I got it. Like, yeah, I actually really like there's like an evil twin joke that you make.
There was a period in the 1980s where every television show,
sure, right.
if you had like a really strong male lead, uh-huh. he would encounter at some point
sure.
a doppelganger, evil version of himself,
right.
with a goatee.
Right.
The
right.
goatee was essential.
I do think the original Star Trek series
with Spock.
They had the mirror universe where Spock was still logical, but he had the goatee and he's evil.
It was sort of the Bizarro Spock.
Kirk was a warlord right. and like all that. So it's like yeah, you definitely if you want to read evil, you throw a goatee on him. So
the goatee is the symbol,
right?
The symbol that what we're really dealing with here is.
I mean, if you're writing this book for Aaron, you could have gotten all the Knight Rider, A-Team, Airwolf, all the references you wanted, and I would have eaten it up. But
so we tried. It's not saturated. The book isn't saturated with snark.
No,
but you know, we wanted to have fun with it. We wanted to have fun writing it.
Right. So that's In fact, I remember like towards the end, we're like, you know what? We're trying to do too much riffing because it is the tone is. Tough. You don't want to be. It's
well. Like, let me give you an example. So, this is one of the, sort of the primary sections that I worked on early on was to describe what religion is, mm-hmm. and so I started with Emile Durkheim, who is a mm-hmm. sociologist,
right?
And the way that I got at Durkheim was to say, okay, so here's what Durkheim says religion is. Now let's figure out what this looks like when comparing Ned Stark and Tywin Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
Like, according to Durkheim's perspective on what to be a good religious society, which of these two characters leaves their family in the best position when they exit the stage? Mm-hmm. So part of that can kind of get a little, you know, if you don't care about Durkheim.
I feel I'm nodding off as you're talking about it. Right.
If you don't care about Emile Durkheim, then damn you. Why are you so anti-French? But no, if you don't care about Emile Durkheim, you're going to need a David Hasselhoff joke
right.
peppered in there.
to smooth things over.
Yeah. I don't know. And but that's just how I think. People that know you from your podcasting days know that you are no stranger to some humorous interjection from time to time.
Yeah, I like to keep it light.
So is that, did we say what the book's about?
The way I describe this book to people, like my elevator pitch is, this is a work of comparative religion that attempts to analyze and interrogate the religions of Westeros and Essos with their real life counterparts and try to derive like all the different parts that George has put together for the individual religions. And then use that as like a lens, you know, because like Game of Thrones analysis and A Song of Ice and Fire analysis has been done to death. We haven't gotten a new book in quite some time. So this just gives you another thing that you can appreciate Ned or Robb Stark or Catelyn. I don't know why I'm stuck on Starks. Tyrion, the Hound.
No, the Starks are...
They're definitely a fan favorite.
They are sort of the initial seed that's planted that
right.
introduces us to the world. So this book, like for instance, will take a concept, like for instance, a particular chapter on the religion of R'hllor.
Mm-hmm.
But then the chapter is going to have sort of a travel guide. Mm-hmm. So there's like if you happen to find yourself in conversation with, you know, a R'hllor missionary. Here's what you're going to want to do about that. We do a deep dive into the religion. We do a character study. We'll do a historical backdrop. Like, for instance, in that chapter, I think we talk about Zoroastrianism.
Right.
Then we'll do a fan theory. Did I ever say fan theory? I don't think I did.
Mm-mm.
So then we'll play up with a fan theory. And then we end with a bird's eye view. We're basically talking not necessarily about the in-world universe, mm-hmm. but we're talking about, you know, maybe a text that influenced Martin or an interview Martin gave that kind of sheds light on the text. So every chapter sort of broken down into these different elements.
Mm-hmm. I feel like at this point you either know the books for you or not.
Do you think that you think people will buy the book?
I think people will buy the book.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Let's release the podcast and find out. So my next question is, you know, obviously, this book was your idea. I was kind of minding my own business in the middle of the winter of this year, and I get an email from you saying, hey, I've been thinking about this, and would you be interested in that? And when did you get the idea? When did you get the idea, and when did you decide to get serious about it?
Well, I think that anyone who listens to Bald Move regularly knows that you have a sort of a religious backstory and that you are kind of still fascinated by religion.
Mm-hmm.
So you're kind of a strange person in that way. A lot of people who have a religious backstory end up trying to sort of bracket it out or forget it or whatever.
Right.
Rather than deal with it. So I think a lot of the times you in your podcast you would sort of bring up some of the religious parts of the story, and so I thought, and I was a Bald Move listener, so I was thinking, well, here's a guy that's interested in enough in sort of the way people think and the way the world works, basically, and the way the medieval world has to work. If it's sort of rife with religious pluralism. And I thought, it would be really fun. It'd be really fun to sort of get really sort of in the weeds mm-hmm. with religion. And I figured, I bet you Aaron would be down for something like this. He seems like a kind of a curious and open-minded kind of guy.
I was your first choice.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely.
Oh, I'm flattered. I never asked you that before.
I mean, I never asked.
I first asked David Chin.
I never asked Martin. He said no.
Then I went, yeah. then I sent a request through Martin's agent.
Yeah,
and
no. No, I figured it would be good because at that point I hadn't read A World of Ice and Fire yet.
Right.
And I figured you probably had. And I thought if I could sort of bring some of the sort of religious studies aspect of this, and Aaron could bring sort of the deep knowledge of the lore, then maybe my chocolate would be in your peanut butter, so to speak.
It was a nice synthesis, I thought, because like a lot of times, you know, in the early goings, because you had an idea for a few kind of chapters on your own, and then like that would springboard other conversations, and sometimes, you know, you would send me a text like, you know, I got this thing, can you think of an example from Game of Thrones? I'm like, well, that reminds me of blah, blah, blah. But then simultaneously, when I'd read your stuff and you're talking about like the different ways that these, the real life religions intersect, that I, that would like prick something from my religious education.
And I think eventually it started working in reverse too, because I remember thinking early on, like, boy, this sort of Westerosi democracy thing, I'm not sure if this is going to work out. It seems like Aaron's putting a lot of stock into this. And then when I started reading through World of Ice and Fire, I was thinking, oh no, this is, there's like four or five different examples of democracy in Martin's world.
That's what I've been screaming for the last few seasons. Like people like, oh, that's, and you're going to have a proto-democracy. That's anachronistic. And I'm like,
So eventually I was kind of won over and I thought, no, this actually would be a great way to end book one. All right, so this kind of brings us to a question I've been wanting to ask you, and I never have.
Uh-huh.
So this is as good a place as any. So clearly you've got a religious backstory.
Mm-hmm.
You might have talked about this on the pod before, but I wonder if your story kind of uniquely prepares you to appreciate story like golden age of television offerings like Game of Thrones and Leftovers that are playing with religious themes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like your journey prepared you in some way to give the criticism that you're able to give with those kinds of television shows?
I think the only thing that, or the one of the things I bring to these types of tables is the fact that I was deeply religious and deeply devout to a very quirky, culty, very fundamentalist branch of Christianity. So, like, it's very hard for me to, in a way that a lot of people that are like, you know, dyed in the wool from birth atheists, never had any religious background, they're very dismissive of the topic. And as a consequence, I remember being the kid that was very devout, very, very devout Jehovah's Witness, but loved Star Trek. And it always kind of bummed me out when, like, Picard or whatever get on a soapbox about religion and or, like, get on the high horse about evolution. And I always felt like I was talked down to and disrespected. I didn't stop watching because, like, you know, geez, if you're going to – there's two options if you're a very religious, fundamental person and you're wanting to enjoy pop culture. You either have to swallow a little bit of that or you just got to unplug from pop culture altogether. And I loved me my starships and my phasers and my photon torpedoes. So I always remember what it's like that. Like, I don't think that if you're a person of religious faith that you're a dummy or you're deluded or you're – it's fascinating. And it's sometimes – in a lot of ways, I miss it. I miss the certainty and kind of the peace and like sense of like belonging and like the universe is kind of clicking over for you to have like that genuine faith. So like when I get approach a topic of Leftovers, for example, I thought that I did well because I could articulate a voice of a character like Matt, who was a devout Christian, even, you know, in this kind of like apocalyptic age. I could also get in the mind of a guy like Kevin Garvey, who is a pretty rationalist, but he is seeing these incredible things. And he's you know, kind of like Saul on the road to Damascus. He doesn't want to believe, but he's kind of forced to. I've often wondered, what if I went out my front door and I saw the Tetragrammaton 500 miles high written in flames across the sky? I mean, Jim and I talk about this podcast. Like, my reaction is like, I guess I'd hit my knees had hit the ground. I'd start praying because like I done fucked up. Maybe I see myself as a translator between those. Like,
right.
You got primarily an atheist topic that I can approach from a place of like, you know, faith and respect for that tradition. Or if it's a religious topic and I'm trying to break down like what this feels like to someone that maybe not have felt it. I can do that. I've got an ear. Like, I haven't lost that ear of like the faith. Like, ooh, that hits me funny, you know. And that's something I think it works well with Gemini's. That like I've heard so many times, tell the truth with love. You know, you can tell your truth right. and how you approach it from a way that's not alienating and a way that, like, makes sense.
Right. So you have a certain empathy. You have a certain empathy for people who are religious way down in their bones.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because how can I hate that person? Because that person used to be me.
I think a lot of people do hate that person primarily because it used to be them.
I think that is an interesting reaction that should be worked through by people. Because, you know, what's hate get you at the end of the day?
No, I think you're right about that. And I think with something like Game of Thrones, I mean, I think that there's so much in that narrative that's sort of foreign,
mm-hmm.
right? That, you know, you're sort of trying to navigate, you know, as a reader or a viewer, you're sort of trying to translate what it would be like to be in a pre-technological society, what it would be like to live in a world where at any moment someone could bombard you on the King's Road and just...
Right.
You know, the medieval world is just a completely different place.
Right.
I think a lot of times you can kind of miss how religious it is
mm-hmm.
until, like, someone like Melisandre comes up and, like, puts it in your face.
Right.
Right. So, in fact, I saw an interview with Martin once where the person interviewing him said, you know, there's not really a whole lot of religion in your books, though.
Mm.
And he kind of looked at her incredulously and just said, it's all over the place. What are you right. talking about? So I think maybe because you have developed a sense of sort of like you use the word translator, because you have been able to translate the sacred and the secular for so long in your own life that it makes you kind of a good translator for people who may not see how religious Martin's world is
mm-hmm.
and why it even matters,
mm-hmm.
right? Why would this even matter to someone like Tyrion, for instance, who is pretty, you know, sacrilegious?
Right.
What is it about his world that's motivating him that relates in some way to the religion of his birth and the religion that he's eventually converting to?
Yeah, that's another thing that I think draws me to things like The Leftovers and Game of Thrones, because I'm very interested in why and how people change their core belief system. As someone that's changed a lot in the last decade or two, I'm interested in seeing people like Tyrion, who is one of the flag bearers of the skeptic standard in Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
start to get a form of faith, maybe not in organized religion, but in a power greater than him, even if that's just dragons and Dany. Mm-hmm. Seeing the Hound, you know, start to soften and think, you know, maybe there's something, you know, beneath all the bullshit and pageantry of knighthood and all this other crap. Maybe there is something to, like, this core faith and this, like, maybe you can find absolution and love and forgiveness.
Even if it's not comforting to the Hound, he's sort of...
Right.
He's being forced to rethink a few categories.
Right. It reminds me a lot of, actually... is it Jack London's White Fang? Like, he's this vicious animal, but he's like the whole plot of White Fang. He finds himself all these different masters, and like there's the master of hate right. and the master of pain. At the end, he finds mm-hmm. the master of love. That like it doesn't feel right. Like, I'm in this warm house, and like this right. guy's wanting. He's raising his hand, and is he going to hit me? But oh, he's petting me, and I don't like this. But it kind of feels good too.
Right.
There's a little bit of that with if you read between the lines with the Hound and his experience in the Quiet Isle. If you're into books right. or with Septon McShane in the
sure,
show where
sure.
you can see that he's bristling because he doesn't want uh-huh. to accept this
uh-huh.
but he's trying or it's winning him over
until
someone yeah. kills the Septon and he has to eat every chicken in the room again, so
I mean, I think that's part of one of the challenges for writing this book is to not only sort of explain how these religious systems work in world, but also talk about how these key characters
mm-hmm.
have to sort of navigate this world of religion, even if they themselves are not the most pious people in the world. They've got to sort of figure out
right.
how to sort of use the veneer of religion as sort of a political weapon, or you're like Arya, you encounter someone from a different culture, and then you wonder, like, is this, if this, you know, are these faceless men, are they going to be able to solve something for me that I, that the gods of the North and the gods of the South probably couldn't solve for me?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to me to sort of look at the history, the real world history of the Middle Ages, and start asking questions like, well, what would it have been like for someone like Arya or Tyrion, you know, start examining some other religion that is not their birth religion,
mm-hmm.
and decide, I'm gonna look into this. This is too good to be true.
Right.
But boy, if this could solve some of my problems, I'm going for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's interesting too how you know, I grew up. If you grew up in a religious tradition, I think it's amazing how much you assume that everybody else kind of rolls Judeo-Christian.
Right.
And I remember, like, one of the first things I was reading something about the Mongols and how Genghis Khan would not, you know, the idea that someone would convert to their religion was absurd to them, because we worship these gods that live in the mountains, like the Himalayans, right. And like, you know, it's obvious why we would think they're awesome, but why would anyone else give a shit about them? So, right. Like, keep worshiping your gods. Our gods are up in the mountain. They're great. We like them. They're powerful. Sure. We're obviously kicking your ass. Maybe your god wants us to kick your ass too. But the idea that, like, it wouldn't be, like, I always thought that every time a religion would come into conflict, it would have to, like, one would dominate the other, and it's always like, you got to convert to this. And but
yeah, I mean, I think you just described the sort of the modus operandi of Rome.
Yes,
which is basically, you know, we're going to rule the world,
right?
And you're going to pay tribute,
right?
And we're going to put up a temple to the Caesar,
right?
Or, you know, or Jupiter or whatever,
right?
We're going to put up a temple in your town.
Right.
And we just assume that you're going to keep worshiping your gods.
Yeah.
And as long as you pay tribute and, you know, bow when the Caesar comes to town,
right.
we're good.
And they're very peanut butter and chocolate. Like, ooh, I like your Jesus. Let's make his birthday be
right.
The return of when our son comes back. And then we got these pagans. Let's bring some tree worship into it.
Right.
And,
yeah. So I think that there were a lot of in the ancient world, there were a lot of religious systems that were geography specific, like the one you were just talking about. But I think that if you look at the Faith of the Seven, you know, Martin has said this is sort of loosely based on Catholicism. But I think that there's a lot of different stages of Roman religion in the Faith of the Seven.
Right.
And I think everything, even going back to sort of the early Andals that are living in these hills, the fact that there are actually seven aspects of God, this is all very sort of early Roman mythology stuff. And then you see the Romans grab on to sort of Mithras worship. You go into some of these Mithraic temples and you see seven altars.
Hmm.
And one of the altars is to a raven, but then you've got like a soldier and you've got a father. And then, of course, you've got, when you move into the Christian era of the Roman Empire, you bring in like the Virgin Mary. And so now you're getting. So I think what Martin does with most of his religions is he kind of starts with a key concept.
Mm-hmm.
Like he may start with the key concept of like Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
But then what he'll do is he'll borrow from like a bunch of different puzzles,
right?
And like force a few pieces together,
or maybe go backwards in a religion's evolution and be like, what if this gene was dominant instead of this one?
Yes, right. So what if when Christianity emerged, it borrowed the Mithras seven instead of the Trinitarian mm-hmm. idea. Mm-hmm.
The Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
So yeah. I think that's what in a lot of cases I think Martin is doing. He's sort of really studying the medieval world and grabbing from a bunch of different religions and sort of putting them into the gravity well of one particular concept, like the Trinity or something like that.
Right.
We should probably say that the book, this particular book, Gods of Thrones, that we really are dealing with both books and and HBO Universe.
We're like we're biblical scholars trying to decide what's canon and what's apocrypha.
Yeah, no, we got the gospel. We got Gospel of John, Gospel of Matthew, and they are certainly not saying the same thing. And we're comparing and contrasting. So we will call out sometimes in the book, this is a show only detail.
Right.
Like the hound latching on to the faith of R'hllor.
Mm-hmm.
That's show only.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, it seems like if you buy the gravedigger theory,
mm-hmm.
seems like he's latched on in some way to the faith of the seven. Mm-hmm. Right. So in the book,
and he does that in the show too, but just that,
like half an episode.
Right. He has half an episode, and then he gets adopted by the.
Sure. That's how long a pacifist lives in George's world.
Right. Right.
Okay. Yeah. No. So I just want to make that clear that this book is for both kinds of fans.
Yes. Right? Yes. Like if you have been listening to our spoiler section for a long time, then you're going to be right at home with these, right. with these books.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
So we're going to be taking feedback, of course, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, or there'll be some topics on the forums if you want to check out our Game of Thrones section on the forums. Since this is our first in the series, we don't have any feedback, but Anthony and I did do some Q&As on Reddit, and I thought just to get the ball rolling, we'd consider a couple of the questions from there. Anani Matthew says, what society or civilization within Westeros or Essos seems to be the most agnostic or atheist as a whole? And what modern society is the closest parallel?
Would you say the Maesters?
I think, yeah, we're both in agreement that the Maesters of the Citadel seem to be the most secular of societal segments?
You know, it's a really good question, because this is one of those times where we don't know enough about the Maesters yet to actually do a full chapter in either volume. But it definitely looks like the way that Martin has set this thing up toward the end of Dance, that the Maesters are super important, and they have sort of their own sort of political machinations.
Right.
And, you know, maybe explicitly sort of anti-Targaryen. But we just don't know enough. We don't know enough about their motives or how they imagine the chess board to look to imagine which pieces they'll move around.
I don't want to spoil too much of a fan theory section, but we traffic a little bit in the theory about the Maesters really going further than just, you know, subtly nudging, but to the idea that they might have engineered the Faith of the Seven.
Right.
This is like an engineered secular thing that they're trying to... An
opiate for the masses.
Yeah, to bend society to their will. There's, you know, evidence, and especially in the books,
where... milk of the poppy for the populace.
Yeah. A milk of the populace.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
And also in the books themselves, they even talk about, they introduce the idea, you know, there's radical... mystical maester at the Citadel who kind of spreads this conspiracy theory about the maesters being behind the dragons themselves.
This is why Sam ends up getting some POV chapters.
Yeah.
Toward the end, is that basically we're going to move with Sam down to Old Town, and Sam's going to get to learn about all of the sort of the view of politics from Old Town, right? Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But the theory that we play with, I think in chapter 4 of this book, is that maybe the Faith of the Seven is completely invented because people basically they need something to latch onto, and of course, people like to worship themselves.
Right.
And so if you come up with these seven archetypes, you'll be able to, like Jamie.
Yeah, everybody.
Jamie loves the warrior,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, everyone can find the one that they like identify with.
So maybe the Maesters have invented this religion specifically to sort of, as a veneer, as a veneer, so they can do what they can do their power plays behind the scenes.
Another question, Number Muncher wanted to know what's the most surprising or fun trivia factoid about real world religions that you uncovered in your research?
You go first.
Okay. So I remember there's this one section where we're talking about, you know, fertility goddesses and how they, you know, tie into, I can't remember if it's the Faith of the Seven or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, because the mother is, she oversees the births.
Right.
So she's a kind of fertility goddess.
Right, right, right.
And if you look around the world, there's tons of fertility goddesses.
Right.
But not always.
Right. And you said as this kind of an offhand example, you quote this ancient Egyptian religious text.
Yes.
That basically has God jerking himself off into his own mouth.
And he spit
it out to give life.
He spits his own seed.
And it's the description is so like dryly religious, pornographic, God like that's some shit you'd see on the really shady sections of Pornhub, right?
Well, this is the
and I just like I remember sending a note back like, is this quote for real? Like I just burst out laughing.
Well, it's one of these things that I try it's a real poem. It's a real Egyptian poem
from creation myth
from the Old Kingdom.
Yep.
And I tried to include it in a previous book, and the response that I got was, I know it's real, but you can't, this is just too disgusting.
The publisher said no, you
so
can't.
I figured, look, if I can't include this poem
right
in a Game of Thrones book,
then you'll never get it.
You'll never get it out. Yeah, right now. So yeah, that I think.
Oh, I didn't know that you had like this is like an old score you're trying to settle.
This is an old score, and I win. Just so you know.
No, I was not the angel on your shoulder this time. I'm like, you got any more of those ancient Egyptian quotes? I got close on this one.
Interesting tidbit. Okay, so this is actually a volume 2 detail.
Because that's one of the Kickstarter milestones is we we had a goal and we quit in writing it. It quickly became apparent that we were going to have to start cutting things because to hit our publishing goal of we just had way too much material. Mm-hmm. But then the other way to look at that is, you know, with a little bit more brainstorming and writing and research, you could take this and come up with two books out of it.
That's right.
So one of the Kickstarter milestones we hit was doing two volumes instead of just one.
I think at some point we had a conversation like, well, the chapter is long enough.
Mm-hmm.
But
we still have things on the table.
But we still have some cool stuff we want to talk about.
Yeah, I hate
about.
That we didn't get to this part or that part.
And I think it was just like, let's do two.
Yeah.
So, all right. So this is a volume two detail, because we don't talk about the dragon cult until volume two. So this is sort of a comparative religions approach.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're putting the fictional religions of Westeros in conversation with real life religion. I was really wrestling to find comparative religions that are more Eastern, because Martin's world is basically Western.
Right.
You know, Westeros, basically.
Right. In fact, when you start getting into the Jade Sea,
that's
and the
right.
starts to get Asian.
If you go all the way to Yi Ti,
you
get some parallels with Eastern religion,
uh-huh.
but we know very little about Yi Ti, right?
Right.
But the closest analog I could come up with for the Valyrians
mm-hmm.
is a dragon god mythology out of China.
Mm. Also a famous empire.
Also a very famous ancient empire. One of the factoids that I learned was that so dragons start off as sort of alligator or crocodile lore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're associated with rivers and water and whatnot. And the reason why it rains is that a dragon has gone from the river to the heavens.
Right.
So dragons are kind of like evaporation.
Mm-hmm.
But dragons are, and so dragons are actually good because you need rain.
Right. They're not fearsome beasts
they're fearsome in the same way a crocodile would be.
Right.
But they're ultimately good. So, but you have sort of this yin yang thing going on with dragons and tigers. So
I've heard about this crouch. Some of them crouch, some of them hide. That's right.
So one of the things that these ancient farmers would do in China, if they wanted it to rain, is that they knew that dragons were afraid of tigers.
Mm.
So they'd take a tiger skull and they would drag it along the bed of the river.
To like scare
the... And that would scare the dragon right into the sky.
And then there you go. You get the rain.
So that was a fact that I didn't... I don't know why it gives me such joy, but...
Right.
It probably just the force of habit.
Learning new things, some people say. Yes. Just the act itself is pleasurable. I think that's probably where we should leave things for now. Again, if you have any questions for us, if you want to talk about the book that we've written, or you want to talk about, obviously when Fire and Blood comes out, we're going to be kind of dividing that into thirds and kind of discussing it as a group. But if you have any questions for myself or Anthony over the next couple of weeks, it's easy to get in touch with us. GameofThrones@baldmove.com is the email address. And also there'll be a forum thread on forums.baldmove.com to discuss this stuff. But yeah, well, next couple of weeks we're going to be talking about books. And then four months later we're going to get back into the TV show and see how this thing gets wrapped up. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, if you want to get this book, Gods of Thrones, Anthony, I have written, you can go to Amazon. There will be a link for it. There is, right now, it's just the ebook version. The paperbacks will be available as soon as we get that paperback converted and we get the books in our Kickstarter backers' hands. But we're really excited about it. I'm really proud of the book. We'll talk more about the contents in particular. There's lots of reasons to recommend the book. I think it's interesting. You're going to learn some things about Game of Thrones. You're going to see characters and institutions through new lenses. You might learn some things about the real world. There's fantastic art by our artist, Chase Stone, who did a lot of the art for A World of Ice and Fire. We had him do, you know, since you don't want to step on Martin's toes too much, we had him do more what-if and fan theory type art.
And which is fantastic.
And the cover, which is the first men, like depicting the war of the first men and the children as the men are burning the sacred weirwoods, I think is just so good.
He's amazing.
Yeah,
he's
amazing. It's this and I like everyone that helped us along the way. Our typesetter Steve Gentile, our editors. Like I can't believe we made such a professional book.
I can.
I can't. I just feel like it's like at every step of the process. I thought like as I thought we would deliver solid material. Like the text would be good. But like I've said this a lot on a couple other different podcasts. Like I feel like now that I've seen the finished, it's like they took our text off the street, gave it a nice cut and a shave, and put it in a nice suit. And now it's like present. It's like not just the guy rambling on the corner. He might have some interesting things to say, but now he looks presentable. You might listen to him.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Hopefully, it's a fun read.
Yeah,
I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's not going to be too stodgy. But you know, we might sneak some medicine in with the sugar from time to time.
Indeed. That's it for us. We'll be back next week with another discussion about Gods of Thrones. Check that out again on Amazon. There'll be a link on how you can purchase it in the show notes. And until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
We'll see you later.